Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Now, the list of things that you can buy at the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com. Things to wear like Chicago Reader hats, t-shirts, bandanas, and face masks. Things for your daily life like the Chicago Reader camping mug, Chicago Reader tote bags, and a Chicago Reader reporter's notebook. Things for you to read like our Reader recipes, the Chicago Reader 420 Companion, our Chicago Reader Best Of book series from journalists Maya Duke-Masaba, Mike Sula, Ben Jarofsky, and Lior Galil, the Chicago Reader coloring book, and the Chicago Reader Stay Home puzzle. Find the Chicago Reader store at chicagoreader.com and show your support for the nation's first free weekly newspaper since 1971.
Bonus time of the Ben Jarofsky Show as I speak. It's Friday, July 29th, 2022. I am now going to read to you a headline from today's newspaper to give you a sense of what's going on in the world. Because, you know, as a podcast, ladies and gentlemen, you could be listening to this 20 years from now. Okay? So you'll go to what was going on when Ben had a conversation with his distinguished guest, who he has not introduced yet? What was going on in the universe on Friday, July 29, 2022? And I'll tell you what was going on, people. Here's a headline from the New York Times. Justice Department, wary of backlash, treads lightly on January 6 inquiry. Merrick Garland, Attorney General. That's putting it mildly, treading lightly. He's barely treading at all. Taking his time. Billy. Hey, Merrick Garland, I'm going to tell you something. I heard Donald Trump. He got on the phone. He called the Secretary of State of Georgia. He said, quote, find me 11,000 blank, blank votes I need to make me the winner in Georgia, and I'll do the rest. If that isn't against the law, I don't know what is. So I don't know what you're treading so lightly for. Just Google it. You'll find it. All right. Had to get that off my chest. All right, without further ado, I'm going to ask my distinguished guest to introduce herself. Distinguished guest, introduce yourself.
Well, that's wonderful. I'm distinguished. My name is Ori Pinnock, and I am a retired attorney, formerly civil rights, and native Chicagoan.
Okay, that doesn't even begin. I'm sorry, Ori Pinnock. I mean, gosh, dang it, as the kids say. That doesn't even begin, folks, to tell the story of this woman, okay? She was on the front lines of every civil rights fight in the city of Chicago, 60s, 70s, into the 80s. She was there for Harold Washington and Dr. King, okay? She was there when Johnny Mack, John McDermott, and Lillian Calhoun founded the Chicago Reporter. I just met her at the Chicago Reporter 50th anniversary. All right. She's been in philanthropic Chicago, Foundation Chicago. She's a mover and shaker. She could pick up her phone call right now and Lori Life will come to the phone just like that. So there you go. That's more of an introduction. I'm sorry. Or I had to take over it. That was too modest. Yeah, she is a retired lawyer, but a little more than that. All right. Did I do you justice?
You did more than justice, and I appreciate it. Thank you, Ben. Thank you.
All right. Well, she's a freaking legend, ladies and gentlemen, in the city of Chicago. And Lenny, shout out to Lenny. Lenny says you have to have
Lori. Yes, please, shout out to Miss Lenny. Yes.
Maybe the next alderwoman of the 48th Ward.
That's right. Love her.
All right. So I always have Martin Luther King on my mind, Ori. I know that sounds weird since the man was killed in 1968. And I'll tell you why I have him on my mind and the struggles I have with his legacy, and then we'll kind of take the conversation from there, all right? Dr. Martin Luther King, when I was a kid, was a profound hero of mine, right? I was a little liberal kid growing up to New Deal Democrats in Evanston, Illinois, which is a very, wasn't so liberal then, but it's like pretty much a liberal suburb of the city of Chicago.
One of the most
sheltered. What's that?
One of the most liberal.
Most, one of the most.
Yeah. Well,
classic liberal.
The first to enact reparations. I mean, let's give it credit for standing tall on complex issues.
All right. So so he was a hero, and he preached a lot of different things. He preached acceptance and tolerance. He preached an end to Jim Crow. He preached integration. And he also preached equity and fairness, with the government acting as a force for change if necessary. Okay. And while he was preaching this, he came to Chicago and Chicagoans hit him in the head with a rock, which shows you what Chicagoans think of tolerance, fairness, equity, integration. And then he was for opposing the war in Vietnam. I believe that was part of the reason he was killed in 1968. It seems as though that this country has reduced Dr. King's message to one phrase. From his I Had a Dream speech from 1963, and that one phrase, which is, seems to be the only acceptable phrase to MAGA, is that we only judge people by the content of the character, not the color of their skin, which then enables MAGA to do absolutely all kinds of racist stuff and get away with it. Now, that's my reading of it. And I feel distressed when I come face to face with my reading of it. And Ori, I would love for you to tell me why I'm wrong so I could feel better about the world as we know it. Or tell me how I'm right and how we can move on to make it a better world. So let's start with the first part of it. Do you think I'm right in my assessment? And that's the legacy that so many people in this country have regarding Martin Luther King.
I think you're absolutely correct. But I think that Dr. King, and you know a little of my history, is he was not one entity. I mean, this was a man that stood in the South before, you know, the Klan and others, but also when he was arrested in Birmingham jail, spoke to the people that arrested him, you know, wrote letters from the Birmingham jail to people who had wanted him jailed. And he took the time to talk to the prison guards. So this was not a one type of person. And so I think you're absolutely correct in how MAGA and those who don't want to understand, and I think it's intentional that they don't, have taken part of his message and used it to their benefit. The real issue, and I learned this again going to law school where, you know, again, I'm a Chicagoan, and one of my heroes was Fred Hampton. I'll be honest, you know, the Panther Party. I wasn't a Panther. No, never saying that. But what he stood for and how he did it, particularly when he got people of all races, and there were white, you know, the Young Patriots and others that listened to him, women, because the Panthers were not very equitable as it came to the Black Panther women. That's another issue. So you know, when I went to law school, I'm going to come out like, you know, Fred Hampton, and I am a revolutionary. When I got out of John Marshall Law School, the first thing I could say, well, that ain't going to work, because once you understand the structure of this country's laws, then you know that Dr. King's voice and his message was and still remains essential, but it's equally as essential as that we understand the structure behind this so-called democracy. And I say so-called because it is structurally not designed as a democracy, even though we claim that. So when Dr. King, you know, the Selma March and all of the things he did, and including one of my other heroes who died not too long ago was John Lewis. And as I said to you, the Chicago connection that most people don't get. And one of the reasons Dr. King came to Chicago was because of Diane Nash, who just recently got the Medal of Freedom Award from President Biden. But Diane Nash was a co-founder of SNCC and a native Chicagoan. And she got Dr. King and John Lewis to sit down and talk to each other. Because the civil rights movement was not one thing. And again, the women in the civil rights movement, other than Rosa Parks and, you know, Ella Baker, most of them didn't get, and that's why I'm so proud of that, didn't get the respect they deserve for standing up, not just only to racism, but the sexism of this country. So when you think about Dr. King, you have to think about the complexities of what he was standing for and what needs to be done. And again, the laws, you know, laws can, and we know, can be, you know, it's not just the law. They can be overturned, as we know. And there are laws that, you know, that prohibited, you know, slave owners from teaching slaves how to read. That was a law. That was legal. So the law is not, you know, the essential to solving our complexities of our structural inequality. One of the structural pieces is education. And which is why when we look at how we are educating young people and how young people have been educated and old people in law, and that's why critical race theory gets so much of so frightening to them. If you tell the truth in education, then people are more likely to understand structurally what civil rights is. I went to Englewood High School, you know, back in, you know, the so-called ghetto. They taught civics then. You know, a white teacher taught civics on why it's important for everybody to be able to vote and what you should have to do. At the same time, the Democratic Daily Machine, Master Daily, was telling people who they had to vote for. And when we were voting, that's how we got Anna Lankford elected. And, you know, police would stand in front of the voting booth and voting, whatever it's called, the place where you go to vote. And ask people standing, as they were standing in line, who are they voting for? Which would ask them. Police, white police would ask black people. And we trained some mostly men, young people, through Anna Lankford and some other prominent lawyers, Bill Cousins and some other great lawyers, Jim Montgomery, to tell people quietly, you don't have to answer that. Because they were intimidating people. Well, why are you, you know, and back in the day, before then, and that's why Anna was doing it, they would follow people into the voting booth and press their hand to make sure that they didn't touch the vote, but made sure that they pressed the hand of the vote, the place that they wanted to vote. All of this was part of a democratic city, you know, one of the most prominent in the country. When John F. Kennedy came here to meet with Mayor Daley, Master Daley, he wasn't coming here to worry about winning Chicago. He was coming here to worry about winning Illinois because he knew the Daily Machine had Illinois. So and again, Dr. King came to Chicago because he structurally understood that what he was fighting in the South was also happening in Chicago. The first U.S. Supreme Court, talk about another black woman who did, the decision about racism and public housing came from Chicago. Dorothy Gautreaux versus the Chicago Housing Authority and HUD. That led to national Section 8. For people across the country to use Section 8 to move out of racially segregated communities. Dorothy Gautreaux did. Dr. King knew Dorothy. That case went to the U.S. Supreme Court in 66. Dr. King came here in 66 and applauded her and said thank you and the others who stood with you to fight against segregation in Chicago and public housing. So again, it's structurally and the economics of it in terms of housing, in terms of jobs. I mean, if we don't structurally address civil rights, then it's great to talk about it. I mean, we need to. But again, the Poor People's March in D.C. got Dr. King in trouble with some black people because some black people, especially some prominent one, particularly here in Chicago, Joseph Jackson, Olivet Baptist Church, who stood with Master Daley and told Dr. King to take his communism back south. Joseph Jackson didn't believe in poor people. People are poor because they don't want to work. If they work, they wouldn't be poor. So that divided him from and he was the head of the Southern Baptist, the Southern Baptist Convention. This was not just like a everyday minister, one of the largest Southern Baptist churches in the country. That's Chicago. So when Dr. King came here, he had some idea of what he would be addressing, although not only for him, but for the rest of us. And I'm a Lutheran. My minister was a white Lutheran minister who was a former Marine, who I loved, who helped me understand how we could help get Anna Lankford elected, by the way. A. Sherwood Nelson, whose dissertation got his doctorate on racial inequalities and racial reconciliation. And the Lutheran School of Theology didn't want to give him his PhD on that because it was too controversial. But the dean of the Lutheran School of Theology said, yep, he got his PhD. And that dean, Bill Lesher, joined Inglewood Lutheran, Bethel Lutheran Church in Inglewood to support this kind of ministry. So again, Chicago had, and to some degree still has, but sadly not in the areas like Inglewood that had over 100,000 people when I was here. But Chicago has the draw. I mean, Harold Washington, when Harold's law office was down the street from where I lived, we could run down the street to 63rd and Peoria. I lived on 59th and Peoria. In the summertime, he'd be handing out ice cones. And we didn't know what lawyers meant and didn't care. All we knew is they had good ice cones. And there was a small, petite woman one day there with him. You know, I was getting ready to go into high school, like eighth or ninth grade. And petite woman also handed out ice cones. And we thought maybe that was his wife or, you know. Well, that was Anna Langford. Who knew? They were both lawyers. Her law office was down the street on 63rd and Racine. So, again, this was what Inglewood had the capacity to empower, not just me. I know people who became lawyers out of my church and out of that community, because we could see my mother could say to me with her 10th grade education, if you believe it, you can achieve it. And I could believe it.
Okay, I'd have to do a little annotation here for some of your younger listeners, people younger than the age of 65, maybe. Anna Langford, a legend in Chicago politics, alderwoman of the 16th Ward. I believe she was elected first time in 1971. If I'm wrong, I apologize, but that's around the time she was elected. She's always battling James Taylor, who was an agent of Mayor Daley. I won't call him Massa Daley. It's not my place. I'm just, that would be Mayor.
We called him Big Jim Taylor because, you know, he was a boxer. He had been a boxer.
Oh, yeah. I know all about it. Yes. Yeah. He was the committeeman of the 16th Ward. And then he cut a deal with Jane Byrne. He thought that was going to put him on easy street for the 80s. And then Harold Washington stunned the world in 83 by you. And James Taylor.
And Harold would say this, and I can, you know, that Anna's winning, becoming the first African-American female alderman, empowered him to think, well, if Anna can do it, guess what? You know, and he had gone downstate and done some other things. And, you know, but that empowered him to say, wow, if a black woman can do this, I know this is something, you know. Because again, there and it was on. She would have been the first and only woman, but the Daily Machine, and I don't remember her name, ran a woman on the north side whose husband was a precinct captain, and so that Anna Langford would not get the legend of being the first woman, he would permit her to be the first black woman, but he would not permit her to be the first and only. So there were two women on the city council at the same time.
And then the other person you named William William Cousins, who was an alderman, I believe, of the 8th Ward, and became a judge.
Yes, yes.
Giants. Legends.
But again, and the disinformation, and I can't speak for everybody. I don't pretend to. But for the disinformation, particularly of younger black people that I do try to stay in touch with, and some people, and oh my God, when I think of younger black people and I think of Tanika Lewis Johnson, whose mom I know, Rita Lewis from Inglewood. I mean, you know, so, but she is phenomenal and gives me so much hope because there's so many people, particularly in areas like Inglewood, who feel disrespected, but because when I was talking to young men, when I was doing some, I won't call it training, but speaking about how important it was for them to vote and how they needed to register. And one of them said, why? It doesn't make a difference. And then another said to me, and this kept me quiet, but you know, when we were talking about Obama had just, you know, been elected and, you know, how he came to Chicago because of Harold Washington. And he said it. I mean, I can call him Mo and Bo now because that's where they were before. I knew him before he married Michelle. But, you know, he said, you know, Harold Washington beating the machine was the kind of thing he wanted to be a part of. He came as a community organizer in Elk Hill Gardens, where Dorothy Cottrell had, you know, she wasn't alive then, but where she had led the lawsuit. So he knew a lot of the history of Chicago, more than some, sadly, some residents here. But again, when I was, you know, saying, you know, Chicago helped to produce the first African-American president of this country, and we should be happy. And the young man said, yes. He said, I am truly excited by that. About this, because he said, but it doesn't keep me safe at night. And he's wrong. I mean, so the politics of a city, of a country, of a nation doesn't empower the kind of civil rights that we're talking about. That means, you know, somebody can be safe in their home, you know, Breonna Taylor and others, you know, can be safe in their home and not, you know, accosted by the people supposedly that are supposed to serve and protect them. Harold Washington appointed me to the police board, and I was still in law school then, and my master's in criminal justice, and had done a dissertation on what was then called the Gangster Disciples, the Disciples, not the Gangster Disciples, and the Blackstone Rangers. Anyway, so I had some history. Again, one was from Inglewood, the Disciples, and the Rangers, the Blackstone Rangers were in Woodlawn. Anyway, you know, Harold, the Mayor Washington, you know, appointed me at the time. I became the youngest person on the police board. But there was women like Nancy Wilson, Nancy Jefferson from the West Side. Oh my God, Nancy could, she was a queen. She was the one that at a school board meeting, she said, and she went and sat in the on the school board and took the seat of the president, and Jane Byrne tried to, you know, talk her out. I mean, she, and when Harold ran, he said, I got to talk to Nancy Jefferson, because she's, we used to call her Queen of the West Side, because she understood how Chicago is, when it comes to people, it's not just one city. You have the, you know, you have Chinatown, you have, you know, Greek Town, you have, you know, Swedish man, you have, and the West Side and the South Side, yes, Black people, but not all one thing. And I didn't realize till I got older that structurally, if you want to look, and Dr. King knew this, that people from Louisiana and I think Mississippi are on the West Side, Alabama and Georgia tend to be more on the South Side. I mean, I don't know, I'm a bunch of, but that kind of history of what they bring to the table is very important to know. And so when you're quote, I mean, it's like knowing, you know, that back of the yards had, we used to call it the Irish Mafia, but had a lot more Irish than on the South Side than some parts on the North Side that had, you know, Greeks and, you know, all, anyway, the Chicago is a complex city of many, and my Native American friend used to say tribes. And in some ways that's correct. I mean, and there is an indigenous population still here. So when you're talking about civil rights, it's not just Black, and one person says, it's not just a Black or white issue. It's a structural issue of that has to do with equity in terms of gender identification, in terms of disability. Another Chicago hero, Shiro, Marka Bristow, who, you know, helped to found Access Living and build President Clinton, because I've been in rooms with, accredited the ADA, the Americans with Disability Act, to Marka Bristow, climbing up to the Lincoln Monument on her knees while that was being, you know, discussed. And I mean, he said, you know, Marka really led the nation in terms of disability rights. So again, another Chicago hero. Chicago is complex. It is full of people. As someone, like my pastor used to say, you know, there are many, for as many people that know about Al Capone and the Mafia, that don't know about all the good folk, Black, Black or Green in Chicago, that's problematic. And that's about the country. We need to, and you know this, with disinformation now becoming the news source, we've got to protect the integrity of what we know. Because without that, there can be no civil rights.
All right. I want to go back to a couple things you said. You had a lot to say on a great riff, that opening riff. I was taking notes. And there's so much I could pick up on. But I want to pick up on this one. You were talking about sexism in the movement. And by chance, not too long ago, I talked a lot about this on the show. I saw The Janes, which is a documentary about women in Chicago who set up abortion services because it was illegal then. We may be going back to that thanks to MAGA and Donald Trump and the MAGA Six of the Supreme Court. But they talked in that movie, the women who were the stars of the documentary talked about the sexism they confronted in the movement. And so you were there, you were, a young woman in the 60s and 70s, confronting all these sexists. So Ori, how did you deal with it? When you came up face to face with something really just unabashedly sexist that some movement man said to you, how did you handle it?
Well, it depended. And I say this because Shirley Chisholm, another Shiro, you know, on whose shoulders both Obama and Hillary Clinton, you know, stood. When I first heard her say this, I got angry with her. I think it was in high school when I heard her say she felt she'd been discriminated more as a woman than as a Black person. And I'm like, well, how could that be? That's, you know, that's impossible, blah, blah. Well, guess what? Once I became a lawyer, it became, and got invited to participate or to apply for certain jobs. When I showed up, one of them said, well, I'm here for an interview. And they said, oh, no, I'm sorry. We have Ori Pennick down. I said, I am Ori Pennick. And they went, what? Now, they were either confused that I was Black, but I think they were more confused that I was a woman. Because I had gone when I was at the MacArthur Foundation, while I was in law school, I had gone to an event down in Florida to something. And I went in and something about Ori Pennick. He said, well, Mr. Pennick's not here yet. And I said, no, and he ain't coming. Because I'm pregnant. And the person actually called while I was looking at her, called the MacArthur Foundation and asked them to describe me. Now, this ain't in the 50s. This is the 80s. And the person who hired me as a lawyer, another Shiro, Joyce Hughes, the first African-American general counsel and the first woman general counsel for the CTA Law Department, who Dorval Carter, who is now the head of CTA, worked under. I know Dorval. He worked under Joyce. I think he was like her senior legal advisor, and I was a managing attorney. They gave her, they would say things to the CTA board would say things to her. Well, are you taking minutes? This is the general counsel. Is she taking minutes? So again, you know, it depends on the environment and how you want to be seen, but it also depends. Like I said, at the Panthers, and I can't speak to all the rest of them because I know Fred Hampton, and, you know, but the one on Woodlawn, when we were doing the breakfast, when I was a volunteer for the breakfast program, you know, the Panther men would drive the food. They'd pick up food and they'd drive it in the alley, and you know, their cars would be in the alleyway. The women had to come out in the alley to get the food to take in the kitchen. They wouldn't even bring it in the kitchen, at least the days I was there. Can't speak for no other days. And when you were serving some of the people, including young kids and seniors, if the phone would ring, like a hotline, and a Panther man was standing right there in front of the phone, he'd wait for one of the women to come and answer the phone. I saw this. So I'm sitting there going, well, wait, you all, and you know, Angela Davis told, you know, that, you know, the whole structure of and what Heather Booth talks about, and when I think of one of my other sheroes, Bernardine Dorn, and, you know, and the weather underground. I mean, you know, gender had to be part of what you had to fight for. And it still is. I mean, structurally, if you look at the hundreds of years the Supreme Court has existed, and it takes, 2022 to get the first African female, you know, Supreme Court justice, and you've had two Black men, you had a Latina woman, you had a Jewish woman, Black women, as a group, and again, people used to say this about my friend Mo, Michelle Obama, what was wrong, you know, angry. Michelle's not an angry Black woman. I am an angry Black woman. Get out of my way. Michelle was a sweetheart, very soft-spoken. Now, that didn't mean she took stuff. I mean, she was very clear to draw a line, and, you know, and nobody, including President Obama, crossed that line when she drew it. But, you know, she wasn't angry. I'm angry. And I think that we get defined as one thing. And the civil rights movement sadly didn't do, it did some things, or like Rosa Parks, you know, got acknowledgement, but there was a Black woman who did what Rosa did before Rosa. The difference was she was dark skinned. I think she was pregnant at a young age, and she didn't fit the model that the civil rights movement wanted to follow. So again, when we look and I was, again, blessed to grow up under the tutelage of a doctor, you know, Margaret Burroughs, you know, the Sable Museum, who talked about women's roles. And we had the nerve to call her Gwen Brooks. I don't know how we called her. We didn't call her Mrs. Brooks. We didn't call her, the first Pulitzer Prize winner. We called her Gwen Brooks. You know, I saw women leadership. Anna Langford, I was blessed. My mother, I was blessed to see women in ways that many others were not. And that included white women and Latino women, you know. So again, the structure of civil rights is not one thing. It has to be inclusive. It has to be predefined. It can't be last minute. And I want to throw this in. I was also blessed to go to South Africa shortly after Nelson Mandela was elected. Didn't meet with him, but did meet with Bishop Tutu, who, oh my God, just, you know, was phenomenal. And it was a group of us from Chicago, including Barbara Bowman, Valerie Jarrett's mom, and some others who went. It was an amazing, inspirational visit. But what it did for me was I could structurally see how apartheid survived as many decades as it did. Structurally, because of the same thing we were talking about: divide by gender, divide by education, and then there, divide by color. If you can find a way to divide, like MAGA and others, you can structurally exist forever. And a woman, Cheryl Carolus, the second highest ranking woman in the ANC, African National Council, met with us and said, Congress, I think the African National Congress, said that the biggest problem she felt ANC had with overturning apartheid was taking too much time to make sense of the nonsense. I had no idea what that meant until Trump. When the time got spent, when he would say something stupid or make up words or just, you know, spending that time, taking it away from moving forward progressively to make sense of the nonsense. And all I could see her saying was, I told you. And again, structurally, she was right. If you take time, resources for you, Ben, to talk about why did they come with it, rather than what are the next steps we have to move forward on to overcome X, Y, Z. When we take time to make sense of the nonsense, that is valuable time that we could use to move forward toward the results that we need. And I don't want to defend the Department of Justice because they, you know, but let me just say this. When it comes to the structure of this country, and again, Watergate proved that. Watergate, you know, Nixon, all that. You have to not only dot the I's and cross the T's, you got to double dot, double T, and all of that, because the things that are we take for granted when it comes to that level ain't none. You got to assume everything is going to be on the a line against you when you move forward on that. And I will say, just on what I've heard, and you know, it's all rumor, but I think he's building a case that it's going to be because you have an appellate system and you have a Supreme Court system that he knows is run by you know who, the six you talked about. You don't want to spend all this time doing something that they can get overturned by the appellate or the Supremes. You want to spend time on something that even they're going to have to say, well, excuse me, whoa, we, you know. And so that takes time. It ain't sexy. It ain't funny. The law, the real law, civil rights law can be as boring as you wouldn't want to know, because again, we've been led to believe it's going to be it takes time, and it takes, and quite frankly, it takes you not to know what I know, and that's the problem with, you know, we want to know what everybody's knowing. Now, if I'm going to do this, and I'm speaking, you know, if this is going to be done to win, I can't let you know all that I know right now, because I don't want the other side to know I know it yet.
So, all right. You're playing chess. I'm playing checkers. You're a trained lawyer. I'm a guy in an attic talking into a microphone. Me talking into a microphone and millions of other people put a little pressure on the Merrick Garlands of the world. And so he's deliberating. He's building meticulously his case, as you said.
You don't want to put pressure on him to lose. You know, and that's all I'm saying. Yes, you should put pressure on him, but you don't want that pressure to be on him so that he loses. And if you move him too forward too quickly, that's exactly what could happen.
Okay. And I will say this to that. That's a very valid point. I don't know. I feel I'm well beyond the limits of moving too quickly. We are now in 2022. The phone call I alluded to took place in December of 2020. That was 2 years ago. It's like you found a dead body in the alley. It's 2 years later. And you're like, well, I still don't know if it's dead.
But again, understand that phone call in and of itself, when you look at the law, don't mean squat. I'm just saying to you. And that's what people, when I came out of law school, I said to myself, all this stuff I'm going to do and separate. Law doesn't do that. It really doesn't. It's the people behind it. And we've had some brilliant women, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Oh my God. We've had some brilliant people. And people don't realize she fought for women's rights before she was on the Supreme. You know, you have to look at who has fought the fight in a complex system that has enabled a win, because our structure, don't even get me started. Our structure is not for us, for civil rights to win. The structure, the legal and the so-called structure of our democracy, where you have three of the most powerful entities and one of them, we don't get to elect. How could that be? How could they share equally in power and we, as part of a democracy, don't get to elect the Supreme? Stop that. That's what I'm saying to you. We have to look at it and take, you know, and some of my foreign lawyer friends, you know, especially from Canada, used to, and the UK used to laugh and say democracy and capitalism is an interesting experiment. And I took offense to that. But guess what? You know, because when money can root out all of what we understand as humane and legal rights, if money, and that's what Trump proved. If money can outweigh all of that through capitalism, I don't even mean illegal money, then guess what?
There's no hope. There's hope. I mean,
no, there is hope. But again, Ben, hope if we understand the fight we're going through. Hope if we think this is going to be quick and easy. And, you know, and that's why, you know, my daughters know, you know, social media for me is one of the more, and thank you guys for doing it, one of the most problematic pieces, because everything is easy. I could Google right now. I can say the craziest thing I want, and I could Google somewhere somebody says that's correct, and have a lot of people saying, yay. I mean, how could that be? You know, when again, and again, the structure of the fairness doctrine, and you know that said things that had to be, before you could publish it, it had to be verified, but that was taken away. They took that law away. So guess not. I can say anything I want. Fox News proves that every day. I can have millions of people repeating every crazy thing I say. And ain't no law against that. That's
what I'll tell you. Freedom of speech. The other side, I hear what you're saying. This is on my mind. This is a tangent, but whatever. I'm enjoying this conversation, so let's go down this road. I get all these emails. Follow me in this one, Ori. I get all these emails from far-right groups. I'm not quite sure why. I've never given any money, I swear, Ori. But because I don't take them down, they just keep sending to me. So I know what they're up to because I'm bombarded with them. While I'm talking to you right now, I'll have 20 collecting on my email.
Probably more after they hear this podcast.
So one of them I got today was from some right winger. I think his name is Kirk. And he's up in arms because of The View, the TV show with Whoopi Goldberg on. He's up in arms. He's collecting money. I'm not making this up. Because they said something disparaging about his organization on The View. And he says, I am outraged. This is just an outrageous accusation that is not true. And I'm thinking of suing them. And so he was collecting money. He was just using that to collect money because he didn't specify that he was going to hire a lawyer with the money you gave him. But I was like, this is pretty slick. But the point is this. MAGA cries when any lefty takes exception to what they say. And you go, you are trampling my First Amendment protecting right to say whatever I want because your little snowflake feelings have been hurt. This feller, Whoopi Goldberg says one little nasty thing about him. He's sobbing like a baby and threatening a lawsuit. Now, Ori, I'm telling you, you go back to what Michelle Obama famously said in 2016. She is definitely not an angry woman. She said, when they go low, we go high.
That's right.
Okay. I'm looking at this guy, a total walking contradiction, hypocrite. He reserves the right to say any mean, nasty thing he wants about me or you. But if you say something nasty about him, he's threatening a lawsuit. How can you win a battle for social equity when the forces you are up against do not play by any rules? Go ahead.
Well, again, it depends upon how you want to achieve the battle. And that's what I say. The law is not the inroad for that, because the law will protect crazy people, freedom of speech, crazy people from saying. But again, trying to dismantle the craziness is one of the things. And some of that dismantlement, and I think what you're doing, media, actual real media, not the Fox, whatever, that, I had some things that I can't say because there was a nasty F word, but what we're having now, and sadly, we see what's happening with Russia and others. Our democracy is in such jeopardy now that we have to be willing to stand tall on issues and in the face of issues and push back when somebody says, I'm going to say, because guess what? You can sue anybody for anything. I mean, that's the other thing the law said. I can sue you for just wearing a hat today. I'm going to sue you because, it offended me, blah, blah, blah. And now with GoFundMe, you can raise money for anything. The issue is, how do we as those, and not just, because there are some Republicans who honestly got it and have now said they're independent or they're not, Richard Steele being one and some others. Now, that doesn't mean them. That don't make them liberal, and that don't make them Democrats. But it does.
I mean, Michael Steele.
Michael Steele, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Richard Steele's a good friend of this show.
That's why I meant, thank you, Michael Steele. But Richard Steele is good too, easy. But, Michael Steele. But I'm just saying to you that they have stepped away from the Republican institutional party. But they haven't stepped far enough away to be able to chastise and to take on the mis and disagree. I mean, what's happening with Liz Cheney is beyond belief to me. I mean, this is, seeing her, I'm like, what? Is that really his daughter? Is that, I keep looking at it. I guess that's her. I mean, but again, even she has got to the point of, oh my God, we can't. And that's how bad it is. And this is not an easy subject. It's not a 1-2-3 win. And it has to start with younger people, because you and I, especially me, done our due, but we've got to enable younger people of all races, of all classes, of all genders to understand structurally what is at stake. And that doesn't mean they have to be a politician, because, that's what Michelle and I, we called her Mo, and I agreed upon. We never wanted to run for anything. But in fact, we used to say we'd run away from politics, not run to, But, the issue is it takes political wisdom, it takes political guts, quite frankly. And Harold Washington used to say when he was, downstate and particularly after he went to Congress and they wanted him to come back, to run for mayor, he said, and I know I'm misquoting this, but he said something like, having a voice is sometimes more important than having a vote, because depending upon the structure, that vote may not accomplish anything. But the voice of the people, and uptown and that, is essential to moving things forward in a structural way. And I've added some of that last part of it. But, again, if we don't continue to have the kind of discussion you're having here, and hopefully, among younger people and others, so that they can be heard, because many of them, I want to end with this statement because it broke my heart when I was talking to this group of young people in Inglewood and Marquette Park, believe it or not, Marquette Park Bank, which I never thought I'd live to be in Marquette Park. And they had a black security guard. I wanted to take his picture, but he wouldn't let me. I'm like, whoa, Dr. King. But anyway, so I'm speaking at Marquette Park Bank and, to these young people, I introduced myself. I went to Inglewood High School. I grew up on 59th and Peoria in Inglewood, and, I have 3 degrees, no brag, just fact, because I want you to know, at University of Illinois Circle Campus, never left town, to help them know that I knew, 60, And when I was leaving, and this was a young man still in high school, and he said, thank you, for coming. He said, can you do us a favor? And he said, when you meet people, and I know he meant, you know, not black people, you know, can you introduce yourself by saying, you know, can you start by saying you grew up in Inglewood and you have 3 degrees? Because they don't believe people like you exist. And then when he said, do it for us, I was speechless, and I'm never speechless. But, you know, the fact that this young man believes, one, that people don't believe, like people like me or him who's in school trying to go to college, is a sad part. Because what I want to say to them is, you know, there are white people that care. There are people of all colors, all genders that care. But they have separated us through segregation in housing, through segregation in schools, through segregation in education, so that they don't know that there are people who care, which is why, you know, Heather Booth and you know, people like her in Chicago and other places, white women, white men, I mean, you know, the Chicago Reporter, John McDermott, and Dr. King knew this, which is why he was so intentful. One of the reasons why he wanted to go to Market Park, it didn't work that way, because he thought, you know, there would be whites, and there were some, they just weren't outnumbered, that would stand up and be a part of what he was, what the movement was claiming. So I think it is complex. It's not, you know, a win-all strategy, 1, 2, 3. Roe v. Wade is, you know, but the one that was enacted before then, that was left before them, was the Voting Rights Bill. The fact that that has been taken away, especially in the South, you know, I mean, and, you know, now they're calling it a John Lewis Voting Rights. I don't know if I'll live to see that pass. But that's structural. And we've got, you know, because if I can't vote, it doesn't, you know, as the young man said, it doesn't matter about any of these other things.
Well, we've run out of time here, Ori, but I certainly hope you and I both live long enough to see that John Lewis bill passed. And that John Lewis bill is intended to block an election steal. That's very real.
And you should do, because many people don't realize that's new. That was not in the original bill, the Voting Rights Bill. So this is an add-on that is exactly what you're talking about.
Absolutely. And named for the great congressman from Georgia, John Lewis, civil rights leader and ally of Dr. King. He was the young guy. John Lewis was like the young man, and King was. It's so weird because they were only like 10 years apart when you think about it, Ori. You know what I mean? But back
a lot back then. And again, Diane Nash, you know, recognized that they had so much in common. And she would say, you have more in common than you think. Because they thought SNCC was just a bunch of young kids running around doing, getting in trouble, you know, blah, blah, blah. And as John Lewis would say, yeah, getting in good trouble. But, you know, she brought
Diane
them
Nash. You know. The great Diane Nash from Chicago, and she was married to James Bevel. People forget that name. I knew Bevel. Kind of went wrong at the end, but that's a whole other show.
That's a whole other story. Yes. Sadly, that's a whole other story.
Yeah, that's a whole other story. All right, Ori, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me and setting me straight. I'm not quite sure I'm 100% with you on that one, but... I'll give Merrick Garland the benefit of the doubt, thanks to you, for another week at least.
But you said for another weekend, that's right.
Well, a week, you know, at least. Okay.
At least another week. Because again, doing the right thing through the law ain't quick and easy. I'm just telling you. So.
Well, I know one thing's for certain. It's not quick. That is... Take your time, Merrick. You heard the story about the hare and the tortoise. You know, sometimes the tortoise wins the race, okay? wah, 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 wah. I'm just kidding, Ori. Anyway, Ori, thank you very much. And Lenny, thank you very much for suggesting that I bring Ori. She's going to be a regular because you said this to me before we went on. You have the gift of gab, and you have been blessed with that gift. And you got a lot to offer. So thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me. And I hope you come back real soon. All right.
Thank you.
All right. That's a great Ori Panic. She's a legend in the city of Chicago, ladies and gentlemen. No, she's not just some lawyer, like she said in the introduction. And I'm very pleased that she could be a guest on my show. That's Ori Panic. I'm Ben Jarofsky. Take care, everybody.